Today on The Horse Race, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker announced he will not run for re-election in 2022. Then, what should we expect from the new Omicron variant of the coronavirus, and how is Massachusetts preparing? It's Thursday, December 2nd.
Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Jennifer Smith. I'm here with Steve Kozella, and Lisa Kaczynski is going to join us in a little bit to help us break down this insanely busy news day. But before that, you may have noticed we weren't here last week. We were eating Thanksgiving dinner, I assume for the entire week. Steve, did you have a good time?
Everybody was sad that we weren't here last week. That's mostly what I was just getting DMs and text messages like, where is your Thanksgiving poll episode, which we didn't do last week. I did have a good Thanksgiving, though. I like Thanksgiving, and I'm very much on Team Turkey, which I saw it in some polls is actually a source of a lot of division in America. People who do like turkey versus people who don't like turkey.
I think it's just that turkey is really easy to screw up, which in our household, we found a nice workaround for it, which is if you have a dry turkey, just douse it in gravy. Problem solved. It's made with the turkey. It tastes like turkey. And then you have just this delicious combination of things.
The solution that last year, I think we discovered was that the recipe from Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat for buttermilk chicken can be adapted for turkey, and it is stellar. Ooh. So I never used to be a huge turkey fan either, because like the flavors that you try to like put on the outside never really get all the way inside. And but marinating it in buttermilk and salt, that's really all it takes. And it is awesome.
Look at that.
I think the people who don't like turkey are mostly the ones that just like wang it in the oven with like wait till that little white thing pops out, and like that's the entire cooking process. And I agree, then turkey is gross if that's all you do. So
yeah, but I would also say that, you know, badly cooked anything is also gross. So here's my hot take. You did make reference to our usual Thanksgiving poll review of favorite foods, and I am absolutely devastated that the only food polling we have this year was dunking on candy corn, but then no one supporting my love of all things potato.
Yeah, no, I didn't actually see the same usual lineup. Last year, we had a really good lineup, which my main recollection of it is that you and your fellow Westerners eat a lot of really cool stuff, and we eat a lot of things like molded and Jell-O and like fruit salad and things.
Yeah, no tamale representation over here in the Northeast. It's upsetting.
But with Thanksgiving in the rearview mirror, now we're all on to making Dukakis soup, which, of course, is little more than turkey stock with a cool name. And we're also on to what has become an absolutely insane news week. We have a lot going on, a lot to talk about this week. So much, actually, that we're not even going to get to it all. Next week, we'll be doing one of our State House update episodes where we'll be talking to some reporters up there who have been keeping close track of the ARPA bill, which, of course, is the legislature's agreement that they came to this week on how to spend this huge influx of cash that's come from federal legislation. We're not really going to talk about it this week because there's so much else going on.
You want to get to that something else now, Steve?
Giddy up. Sorry.
If you listen to this podcast, you've no doubt heard by now that Governor Charlie Baker is not running for re-election. Neither is Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito. So what does that all mean for Massachusetts, for the gubernatorial election next year, and frankly, for the Massachusetts Republican Party? Well, Lisa, our special breaking news correspondent, is on site at the State House right now, frantically juggling between press conferences. Ma'am, how have the last 24 hours been on this roller coaster?
Roller coaster is a good term for it. So the rumor mill started churning Tuesday night. By Wednesday morning, we knew an announcement was coming, and then it was here. And I think it surprised a lot of people. It surprised me. It sounds like from my sources that the governor was torn about this decision. He had been actively debating it heading into the Thanksgiving holiday when he huddled with his family, made a decision over that, and started communicating it to allies shortly after.
So there's going to be a press conference this afternoon with some elaboration, but we do have a statement from both Baker and Polito that talked about a few things. Would you mind kind of breaking down what we know so far about what this decision was based on?
Yeah, part of it seems to have to do with their families. You know, it's no secret that they're, you know, family-oriented people. And they mentioned that. They also mentioned, you know, recovery from the pandemic and just not wanting to make, you know, heading into this winter with the new variant and continued recovery from the pandemic. They didn't want to cloud that with a nasty re-election battle, which they hinted at, and which it likely would have been likely a brutal primary where he would have been challenged from the right by Jeff Diehl, who was already, you know, pressing him on various issues, as well as the heat that he would have taken from the Democrats.
Yeah, we saw that show up in the polls, too. I mean, this was one thing that just for the last few weeks has been showing up in polls that have been done, kind of following the Boston mayoral election. There have been a few statewide polls that have been released, not necessarily like big media polls or anything like that, but just polls kind of bubbling up from here and there. And then one from the University of Massachusetts. And they all kind of show the same thing, which is, as you mentioned, Lisa, his path through the Republican primary was not an easy one. You know, we kind of think Charlie Baker's a super popular governor or has been a super popular governor. Of course, he would be the front runner. But in the primary electorate has moved very much toward the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party. So just a few of the numbers to kind of illustrate it. In the PPP poll of the primary, of the Republican primary, Donald Trump had 81% favorables compared to Charlie Baker, who had 30%. There was also one done by Northwind Strategies and Change Research. That one found him with 23% favorables among Republican primary voters. That same poll from PPP showed him actually losing the Republican primary by 21 to Jeff Diehl. So obviously it's that all those polls were very early. None of them say like this is exactly how it would have turned out. But it all illustrates the problem that he would have faced, which is that he's very much out of step with where the Mass GOP is these days.
And those polls also seem to show similar issues for Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido. And then she was the heir apparent to Baker, you know, in the Republican side of things. But I've been starting to get the sense over the past few days leading up to this announcement that she might have been out as well. And that seemed to be the more surprising announcement possibly of the two of these. But, you know, the polls had indicated that she also had a really difficult path were she to be the standard bearer for the Baker-Pulido administration in this primary.
What does this tell us about how people are going to be running for the Republican primary here? Obviously, I was struck by Jeff Diehl's statement coming out after this announcement, noting that though he had butted heads with Baker and Pulido in the past, he liked them personally, but then immediately highlighted that Donald Trump had endorsed him. So is there an indication that even if Diehl's name isn't the only one on the list, there's an understanding now that to run for a Republican nomination in Massachusetts, you have to be running on essentially a Trump ticket as opposed to a Baker ticket?
The base in the Republican Party in Massachusetts right now, there's a vocal pro-Trump contingent. How large that is something that probably would have been seen in this primary had Baker and Jeff Diehl both run. But it's definitely a vocal and sizable group of people.
The polling does offer some answers on this. So again, looking at that DGA poll, the Democratic Governors Association poll, in that one, 22% of Republican primary voters said they thought Joe Biden was legitimately elected president. And 75% said that they would prefer the Republican nominee for governor embrace Donald Trump's agenda. So that pretty much tells you where the primary electorate is these days. I mean, there is one note that a bunch of people have offered on Twitter, which is that unenrolled voters can pull either ballot in the in Massachusetts, either the Republican or Democratic primary ballot. And even recently, it's gotten to the point where about twice as many voters in the Republican primary are actually unenrolled compared to registered Republicans. But that's not enough to make up for this. That's not enough to make up for the voters who today think they would participate, only a quarter of them saying that they view Baker favorably. There's no way that there would be enough of a tidal wave of moderate to left-leaning independents deciding to come save Charlie Baker. You know, I think that's been the challenge that these polls have outlined. So yes, unenrolled voters can do that, but the polls as they are today do include unenrolled voters, and how bad they are for Baker, I think, really casts doubt on whether or not that could ever be enough to save him from these numbers.
And exactly to that point, too, there's kind of a sense today in the wake of this announcement that the Democrats are going to kind of like saunter their way through into the corner office, so to speak. at the end of this, but of course, it could still be a pretty ugly primary on the Democratic side. We've got a number of candidates already in, but we're still waiting on possibly the biggest name in the room, A.G. Maura Healey. And then among the 70 million names that were thrown out today on ye olde Mappily Twitter, of course, is Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh as well. Allegedly, reportedly, however we want to hedge it, considering whether or not a gubernatorial run looks good. So, I mean, we could still see a pretty competitive race. It just might happen before November.
And Lisa, you've already been reporting on some of the names who are in and out. What are you hearing so far about some of the names that have been tossed around?
Well, speaking of Maura Healey, she was just on Bloomberg TV few minutes ago saying, asked of course if she was running for governor. She said, "I'll save that for another day." And so that today was a day to congratulate and acknowledge and appreciate the service of Governor Charlie Baker. So she's not saying yet, but, you know, people around her are pretty excited right now. Of course, you know, people around Baker were pretty excited too in the days leading up to when they found out what his actual decision was. So there are three Democrats who are already in the race and have been running for at least the past half a year, and those are State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz, former State Senator Ben Downing, and Harvard professor Danielle Allen. Some people who are out, former Congressman Joe Kennedy, you know, he's always rumored for governor or attorney general. He's out for both. The Marty Walsh rumor is kicking around. Other names include Mo Cowan. He told me that he's not interested. But yeah, the rumor mill is definitely churning and it's growing by the minute with the names that are cropping up.
And of course, Mo Cowan was the former chief of staff for Governor Deval Patrick and was appointed senator to fill out the rest of John Kerry's term. So, of course, it's a field of notable Mappily names who have said they are not running. And so we have to keep our eye out for anyone who continues to throw their hat in the ring going forward. The question that's still kind of lingering for me about the Baker announcement is it feels sort of like the long and short of it is this marks what feels very much like an end to the Mass GOP's hold on most of state government here. Notably, we just had a loss in the 4th Essex District of a longtime Republican seat to Jamie Belcito. So, Lisa, what's your read on the overall landscape right now?
The Republicans don't have a big bench. That's why Pulido, who didn't really align necessarily with Baker politically, even though, you know, they were obviously linked at the hip in the administration, but she had been more conservative prior to that. That's why she was his heir apparent, because the Republicans don't have a big bench in the state. They haven't had success legislatively, as you just noted, and, you know, have watched their ranks dwindle on Beacon Hill over the past few years. And the intra-party feud is not going away. Just this week, you know, a few dozen state committee members didn't show up to a meeting in protest of Chair Jim Lyons. And he will still be the party chairman through this next election. So with all of that combined, it's a tough road ahead for Republicans in Massachusetts.
Another potential, I think, huge embarrassment for the Mass GOP will be if they don't manage to clear the signature threshold for the ballot questions that they've proposed. You know, the Mass GOP, while they haven't had a huge legislative bench, has actually had a fair amount of influence here with things like, I mean, first of all, the governor, though they've kind of shoved him off to the side, but then also things like their successful campaign a few years back to repeal gas tax indexing. And they had a couple more this year that could potentially have passed and caused, you know, big changes in the way that politics is done here. But it's kind of a sign of the lack of organization and the lack of political power that they wield at this point, that they weren't able to gather the signatures they needed. You know, it's basic stuff, and they couldn't do it.
Well, I mean, as dramatic as today was, the election is still 11 months away. And in pandemic time, that means it's probably about 5 years away. We will be here the whole time covering every angle as we deeply try to and believe only we can, mostly because of Lisa's tireless presence at the State House waiting for a million press conferences. Any final thoughts, Lisa, before you run off to another one?
It's going to be an incredibly interesting next few days, next few months, next year. And the funniest part about all of this is that overshadowed is they just reached a deal on the ARPA spending bill. And that is now completely overshadowed by the governor's race. And the people who are still running, who have been running for governor this whole time, are still being overshadowed today by all of the talk about the people who now might be running for governor because of Charlie Baker and Karen Pulido's decision. So can't wait to see how this race shakes out. And, you know, once these fields settle out a little bit, how the discussions really take shape and where we really go in these primaries.
All right. That's where we leave you for now.
News of a recently discovered variant of the coronavirus has health experts on their toes. President Biden urged Americans to take it seriously but not panic, and urged everyone who is eligible to get a booster shot as soon as possible. So why exactly is this strain, known as Omicron, so concerning to health experts? Here to help us break that down with us is Massachusetts State Representative serving the 9th Suffolk District and Boston Medical Center Emergency Room Doctor John Santiago. Rep. Santiago, thank you for joining us as always.
Great to be here with you two.
So we've heard some news about the mutations, all of which was pretty early, just as scientists were kind of beginning to understand what Omicron is about. But it seems like the news changes daily on how concerned we should actually be. What's the latest on that from your perspective?
Well, it is absolutely a variant of concern. I think it's how the literature says it. I mean, there are, I think, 50 mutations on this, 30 of which are on the spike protein, which the vaccine is supposed to recognize and attack. And I think the data coming out of South Africa suggests that it could be significantly more transmissible. And so when I look at variants, I mean, there are three main questions I want to ask. You know, is the variant more transmissible? Will it result in more severity of symptoms? And will it have a feature of vaccine escape? It's right now too early to say what's going to happen or what will happen. You have to really give it 1 to 2 weeks to see what the scientists and the public health experts will say with respect to those three items. But for right now, we know that there is a variant, not just in South Africa and that region, also all around the world. I think earlier today, they found someone infected in California. So it's safe to say that the virus is spread globally and likely community transmission is happening throughout the globe.
Did we learn anything from the way that we responded to the Delta variant, where it occurs to me we saw something kind of similar where it was popping up in a few spots and then suddenly it was in the States and then suddenly it was everywhere? So what was there about our response to Delta that you hope we either do or don't replicate this time around?
You know, well, we're in a different stage in the pandemic writ large. I mean, we're not operating from square one. I mean, you can recall March 2020, it was a different landscape. You know, we have testing, we have vaccinations, we know how to treat it in the emergency room or throughout the hospital. What's scary now, what's concerning, is just the rate of transmission. So we don't know. I mean, we don't have any evidence to suggest right now that it is more severe. There are some case studies in South Africa that says, look, it is more transmissible. For those who have been vaccinated have had some breakthrough infections, but the symptoms continue to be mild. So we just don't know right now, but we do know what works writ large against the coronavirus, right? We know to mask up, wash hands, you know, quarantine, isolate, and get vaccinated. And here in Massachusetts, we're up to about 3/4 of people have been fully vaccinated. 86% have had at least one vaccination. So we're doing a good job relative to the rest of the country, but we still have significant room to grow with respect to the booster. And I think we're at about 15-20%. And I think we need to start looking at the booster, not as a bonus per se, but really as a standard regimen and how to address and prevent coronavirus.
So when everyday people hear, you know, vaccine escape or evasion or some of the other terms that are used, you know, that I think the image that's conjured in their heads, my head, is 0% effectiveness, which I think it's pretty clear that's not what anybody's saying. They're trying to figure out what the percentage actually is of effectiveness of the vaccine, right? Do we have any sense of that, or is it still a couple more weeks before we really have good data there?
It's going to be, unfortunately, a couple more weeks. But I think you're right, Steve. I think we can feel pretty confident that there will be some level of efficacy. How much, we don't know. I mean, it was startling to see that early on in the pandemic, when the vaccines first came out, the mRNA vaccines, particularly Moderna and Pfizer, there were high levels of efficacy up in the 90s, right? And we do know that over the course of a couple months, there is some waning immunity, right? Hence the boosters. Now, we're going to have to see moving forward in the next 2 weeks with the studies that come out from not just Moderna, Pfizer, but a number of scientists around the world that are looking into this, see if those neutralizing antibodies will be as resilient as they were with the other variants.
And then thinking about things that are not just vaccines and masks, what are your thoughts on any new restrictions? A lot of the conversation, whenever there's a new variant, is do we backtrack on where we're at right now, or is the kind of recommended level of vigilance still what we should be aiming for, and it's just a matter of trying to continue to hit that?
Well, I think, listen, we have new variants pop up all the time. There are many variants that have not hit the public stratosphere yet, but are milling around globally, and I'm sure in this country as well. We have to see whether the Omicron variant is going to outcompete the Delta variant. Right now, the Delta variant is the main strain, the main variant across this country. It could very well be in a matter of weeks, months, where the Omicron looks just as transmissible, if not more, but that remains to be seen. I mean, again, we do know it works. I do think in Massachusetts, we should be masking indoors. I mean, I think the CDC has put forward recommendations to say that in communities where there's high level of transmission, that's what we should be doing. That's not happening across the Commonwealth, as you know. It's happening in Boston. You know, we have it indoor, but it's not happening across the Commonwealth. So that would be my recommendation. Also, when it comes to flights, a lot of people have, expressed some concern about the travel ban. I do as well, right? You have a variant coming out of a region, but the travel ban only picked out certain countries. I think 8 when we knew that there was transmission going on at least 16 countries and likely even more now. And I think the travel ban in hindsight is probably a bit misguided, right? It punishes certain economies. It discourages scientists or certain public health agencies from being very transparent with their data. And also the billions of dollars that are going to be lost in economic trade when it's already propagating in this very country. And so I think from the Massachusetts Commonwealth standpoint, I think we continue what we are doing. Vaccine, really increase the number of boosters that we're getting, make sure children are getting the vaccination as well. As you know, that we've seen a significant increase in infections and cases across the Commonwealth, primarily in children. And we know that children, although symptoms largely are mild, they can transmit to adults. The other big issue we have in Massachusetts is the boarding situation, hospitalizations. Back in March 2020, we had hundreds of people hospitalized in my hospital, but that was a similar situation happening across the Commonwealth. Right now, if you go to any emergency department across the Commonwealth, it is jam-packed. Beds in the hallways, hospitals are full. And so how much more can a healthcare system take? That will be what's most concerning. That's what I'm gonna be looking out for. And as you know, earlier last week, I believe, the governor put forth recommendations to stop and put on hold all elective procedures depending on the boarding at a hospital. So for me, that's what I'm going to be looking at.
So let's then look at the bridge between the two positions that you do hold. Of course, you're an emergency room doctor dealing with this day to day and also a state legislator. And both, I think, in both roles, there's elements of the crisis that you just described, which is hospital capacity. That's also something we're hearing all across the country with enormous numbers of healthcare workers who have either taken a leave of absence or who have just, you know, moved on to other professions or retired or otherwise left. So what can be done? Is this something that the legislature should do something about, or is it something that's more within the healthcare industry, or where are any of the solutions on that problem?
Well, all of the above. I mean, this is an incredibly complicated issue, and some people refer to the problem as ED boarding, emergency department boarding, but this is not an emergency department issue, nor is it a hospital issue. It's a systems issue as well. You have chronically ill people in a system that hasn't been serving them appropriately, right? On top of that, you have this coronavirus that has exacerbated any disparity that was already there. So you have sicker people getting sicker. And so right now we're at a state where in my emergency room, I'm walking the hallways, people are literally waiting hours and hours for beds. The workforce, an incredibly important component to this, as you said, Steve, there are a significant need for nurses, techs, all of the sort. I mean, for the past 2 years, people have been working around the clock, burnout is significantly high. So there are multiple places to impact the system. And I think there's no doubt that from the healthcare system to the nonprofit sector to the legislature, something's going to have to be done because our healthcare system can't withstand this much longer.
So it seems that there's a few inflection points happening all at once right now. You've got, you know, this moment in time where we're a little bit beyond the kind of peak efficacy of the first few rounds of vaccines. We have the potential of this new variant, but minimally we're still dealing with Delta right now. We're about to enter a new wave of holiday travel. At the moment, we just came back from Thanksgiving. People are about to be heading out for Christmas and New Year's. And we're also at kind of a return to office and school moment. So You know, over the next month, you mentioned you're really keeping an eye on kind of hospital capacity and resources, but how are those kinds of connecting factors impacting that calculation for you?
Well, it's to me, the big X factor is the Omicron variant, right? We just don't know the next couple of weeks how it's going to play out, if it's going to really outcompete Delta, how much vaccine escape, if any, will be present. The other thing to notice, and I think you kind of suggested this in your comments, is the winter season. You know, over the past 2 years, I've treated countless coronavirus cases. I've only seen two flu cases, right? And I saw one today, and I saw cases of rhinovirus, RSV, other viruses as well. So to me, winter is here, right? And so what does that mean for hospital capacity, you know, the boarding situation, a variant that has the potential to, make patients sicker, more transmissible, we'll see. But for me, I think, you know, we've been through this before, the healthcare system, the doctors, the nurses, despite how burned out some of us may be, you know, we're ready to get to work and to do the work that's necessary to protect the patients and the healthcare system. But there's no doubt that there's going to have to be some important investments and engagement, not just from the political sphere and the policymakers, but from, you know, the run-of-the-mill nonprofits and public private sector that plays a role in this.
Expand on that, if you would. What specifically do you mean when you say investments by nonprofits or any of the other things? Because I think a lot of people are trying to figure out how they can help. So what are some ways that other sectors could come, you know, be of assistance here?
Well, I mean, you know, the nonprofit sector also includes, you know, community health centers. And that's what I'm talking about, community health centers. You know, all the hospitals in Massachusetts, I mean, not all of them, but many of them are nonprofits as well. And again, you know, we're looking at coronavirus and what has resulted, and look what's happening at the hospital right now. And if you look at the hospitalizations at the large hospitals, the academic medical centers in Boston and throughout the Commonwealth, the vast majority of people waiting for beds or admitted are not there for coronavirus, right? I mean, this is a stain on our healthcare system and what we've seen over the past couple of years. And so what we're going to need is all hands on deck approach, right? You know, how do we address these, what I call the social determinants of health, to prevent what's happening to these patients? You know, how do we address things like diabetes, hypertension, obesity, to prevent a patient getting very sick from a coronavirus, a variant of sorts? So I think the next 2 weeks are going to be very telling in terms of how the virus, you know, moves forward or not, depending on the Omicron and how virulent it is. But we know what to do. We've been through this before. We have treatments, we have prevention, and we know that vaccinations work. So my urge and my plea to all those out there listening, if you haven't been vaccinated, get vaccinated. You should think about the booster shot as a part of the regimen and get booster as soon as you become eligible, and continue to mask up, wash hands, and be as vigilant as possible. And if you are going to participate in any activities throughout the holidays, utilize those rapid tests, you know? And you know, there are countries throughout Europe that are utilizing them much more than we are here in the States. I think we should be using them more. I think domestically, in terms of the flights here, we should be using those pre-departure, maybe post-arrival as well, to make sure that folks aren't getting each other infected. Because if it turns out that the Omicron variant is more transmissible, can cause more severe symptoms, I'm not so sure how much more the healthcare system can take.
So looking at specifically the government response, you mentioned, you know, making rapid tests available. Obviously, right now, there was supposedly, I hope this is true, it's widely reported that there is an agreement on ARPA spending on Beacon Hill right now. So are there any particular efforts that you're seeing that are encouraging coming from either your body here, the legislature, or coming from the governor's office that you think are kind of needed steps to help us as we enter the winter?
Well, I think ARPA was a necessary step. I mean, it was $4 billion injection into the system. Hundreds of millions of dollars went to the healthcare system. Hundreds of millions of dollars went to the mental health care system as well, which we know we're having a crisis that has been exacerbated by COVID-19. And when we talk about boarding in the emergency department and throughout the hospital, there's a part of that that's related to the psychiatric care here, right? Not just beds or infrastructure, but also the staff that needs to be paid here. So I think in the House, we had about a $250 million injection for mental health services. You know, on top of that, related to that as well, substance use is on the rise as well. Here, we had an increase in folks overdosing, an issue I care very much about as someone who reps parts of Mass and Cass and in Boston. And so it's going to be a challenging, you know, couple of weeks moving forward until we determine how virulent this variant is. But also, you know, we've been dealing with a healthcare, the system that needs more funding, a healthcare system that is exhausted, that is burned out. You know, it's difficult to find nurses. It's difficult to convince people to consider a career going into mental health. And so we're really going to have to begin to reimagine how we go about addressing our healthcare system and addressing particularly those social determinants of health. You know, why people fundamentally are sicker than other. It's primarily because I would argue that they come from neighborhoods or cities where they don't have the same economic or educational opportunities as others. And to me, solving those big issues will result in some important outcomes that can really begin to change the health of this commonwealth.
One other issue which has cropped up lately after kind of a long period of silence is digital vaccine passports, the idea that you'd have something on your phone or some other form of identification or paperwork or something that would show, yes, you have been vaccinated, and you could use that for admission to various, you know, places where, you know, the business has to or wants to be sure that you're vaccinated. What are your thoughts on that? How would that work? Is that something we should be doing?
Well, I think it's feasible. I think there are cities across the country that are already doing it. I mean, there are countries in Europe that are already doing it. I think it's something that we should be looking into. I think the governor has expressed an interest in it. I think he, according to what I've read, he's in conversation with several states looking into this, an innovative, quick way to really decrease the onus that it will place on the private sector. But it's important to note that there are parts of the private sector that are already doing this. To go watch the Celtics, I believe, you have to show proof of vaccination. To go to certain restaurants and cafes in Boston, you have to do this as well. And so the private sector is actually leading on this when it comes to Massachusetts. And my hope is that the governor, policymakers, will really take this concept and move forward with it and really determine if it's something that we need to do, given that this potentially very transmissible variant is on the horizon.
All right, then, emergency room doctor and state representative John Santiago, thank you so much for joining us and walking us through all this.
Great.
And that brings us to our final segment of the episode. And this week, that is the Pony Express. So with Charlie Baker and Karen Pulido saying that they are not running for governor in 2022, several people on Twitter asked who would we like to see run, but really ought not to run. And first, the first shout out we have to give to this is to Boston political reporter and all around Twitter superstar Megan Johnson, who had a tweet with tons of good suggestions.
I mean, this was not even related to the horse race, but I think we may need to just shovel all of our trivia points over to her on this one just by default. So she had this list of potential Mass governors, and my personal favorite is her first suggestion, which is Kevin the Stoner Kid from No on Question 4. And a lot of folks noted, this is really cruel to Kevin's mom. Kevin's mom was the breakout star of that No on Question 4 ad. Her delivery of Kevin was just Oscar-worthy.
And something that we all still remember, which is quite something for literally what was a one-line script.
It's the reason health Mom. Professionals are urging Kevin? To vote no on 4.
Some of the other names that she suggested were Marty the Stop and Shop robot, that one woman that drives the Orange Line train and yells at you, Papagino's at the Charlton Plaza, and the giant polar seltzer bear. Those were some of the ideas that she offered. I also asked the question, who should run Wrong Answers Only, and got names like Keytar Bear, Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon. We got Turtle Boy. We got Vermin Supreme, who actually tweeted back and didn't exactly close the door, so maybe we'll be seeing it.
Insinuated that we're looking at a Vermin Supreme gubernatorial race. I think my favorite was possibly Steph Solis's recommendation, the Cambridge turkeys, all of them.
Yeah, that'd
just
be something else.
20 turkeys in a trench coat running for governor of Massachusetts.
So lots of fun to be had there. We appreciate all of your answers. But for now, that's all the time we have this week. I'm Steve Cazella here with Jennifer Smith, thanking our on-site breaking news correspondent, Lisa Kaczynski, for her contributions this week. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts, subscribe to Massachusetts Political Playbook, and ping the Massing Polling Group for polls. But for now, thank you all for listening, and we will see you next week.